I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes. You used to rock me in the cradle of your arms. You said you'd hold me till the pains of life were gone. You said you'd comfort me in times like these, and now I need you. Now I need you. So little beauty, but I know I saw it clearly through your eyes. Now the world outside is such a cold and bitter place. Here inside I have few things that will console. And when I try to hear your voice above the storms of life, then I remember
that's Sweet Honey on the Rock with Wanting Memories. It's from their 1993 album, Still on the Journey. And both the title of the song and the title of the album, one could say back in 1993, were so prophetic considering the events in Charleston, South Carolina, where a 21-year-old gunman ended the lives so brutally of 9 people who had gathered on last Wednesday for a church meeting to study the Bible and to pray, cut them down without warning. Dylan Storm Roof, 21 years old, the alleged lone gunman, believes he struck a blow for white supremacy in America. A 2,000-word so-called manifesto posted on his website laments the inability of whites to keep African Americans, Jews, and Latinos in particular, in check and maintain total control as is divinely ordained. But official opinion, even by President Barack Obama, seems to disagree with Roof's self-declaration for his motives, his own explanation for his motives. He is very clear. It was about white supremacy, and he was acting as its agent. This was not an act of terrorism, we are told, but of hate. But the people telling us this are revising history. This is not the cause. This is not what it is we are looking at, they tell us. It's a whole bunch of other things, but not what we intuitively know and not what history tells us. A lot of political sidestepping is going on. Today, the president is being given there's a lot of attention being given to an interview the president gave with Marc Maron, who does a podcast that is very popular. It's titled, by the way, WTF. What the F? Yes, it means exactly what you think it means. That's what it means. WTF. And the president has a habit of doing this. He explains to a world not only what he thinks they ought to know, but what he thinks the world ought to know about him. And in this most recent interview that aired just yesterday, the president tells us that racism just hasn't gone away. He reminds America through this interview with a comedian, and this is not the first white comedian he has sat down with. He's not talking to the black press. He's not talking to black Americans. He's not talking to Latino press. He's talking to white comedians. And he is instructing the nation of his awareness, and therefore the nation also ought to be aware in the kindest, softest way possible that there's so much work to do in order to move beyond the point of racism. And of course, people are calling it racism because it's a nice word also. It has a softer tinge to it. It is not as rough as white supremacy. Well, just want to bring to your attention a little thing, as we mentioned the word white supremacy. This young man, Mr. Roof, Dylan Storm Roof, who assigned himself as the angel of death in order to basically take on this disruption of the divine order of America, of course, decided to pose with a Confederate flag. And everybody knows what the Confederate flag means, and there's still now a discussion about that. There ought to be a movement to remove the federal flag. Well, it's been there for a long time. And its sentiments are very clear and have been vigorously embraced. And people will have us think that it is just in the South. But white supremacy is a universal American trait. It is all over. Everybody is affected by it. Because as I discussed last week, here we have a false construct, but reinforced militarily, socially, economically, politically, in order to have the self-fulfilling prophecy that for all time there will be a group, and it's a white group. The white group in America will rule all others till the end of time. Just in case people are kind of vague about this intention, everybody knows it. Everybody knows that this is an apartheid society. This is a society scientifically constructed. Isn't it fortuitous that I began this series of discussions and then these things happen to illustrate the point? Just incidentally, coming back to the Confederate flag, the one that is so popular, the one with the crisscrossing blue stripes against a red background, the designer of the flag back in 1863 articulated the intent and meaning of the flag. Here's what he said. As a people, we are fighting to maintain the heaven-ordained supremacy of the white man over the inferior or colored race. A white flag would thus be emblematical of our cause. And in this, what he's explaining is that he had designed a flag with a purely white background, and the crisscrossing, what we know as the battle flag, the Confederate battle flag, occupying one corner of the white flag, the purity of the white flag. And he explained that in 1863. That same year, he wrote in the Daily Morning News, yet another explanation for his design of the flag. And he says, as a national emblem, it is significant to our higher cause, the cause of a superior race and a higher civilization contending against ignorance, infidelity, and barbarism. Another merit of the flag is that it bears no resemblance to the now infamous banner of the Yankee Vandals. So in case people are not clear what the flag is about and what adherence to this flag and the symbolism of the flag are identifying with, the designer of the flag explains exactly what the flag means and should mean, what the flag is meant to convey. And this is a flag that's flying not only in South Carolina and in Georgia as well. And you see it all around in Florida, where I am. There are people who ride around with the flag very, very prominently displayed on their pickup trucks and ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, and whatever else they're riding. So if you're confused, if somebody's confused about the Confederate flag, and that it is not at all accidental that Dylan Storm Roof embraces this flag and the philosophy behind it, if anybody is confused about this notion of white supremacy, the designer of the flag explains that it is to convey white supremacy. That's so if you're puzzled, disabuse yourself of any notions that you have about the Confederate flag. Well, let's go to this business. You know, we live in the reality today. We're learning that the owner of the team, I'm trying to remember the name of the team in South Carolina, the owner of the Carolina Panthers has committed to paying for the funerals of those killed, as well as an equal amount, each family to receive $10,000, the church also to receive $10,000. It's a wonderful offer, and it speaks to a humanity. And it speaks to a humanity that is shared, but not often enough, and shown not often enough. Because essentially, this still comes from this position that the victims are the ones bearing the brunt of it all. The victims, you know, the president irritated the heck out of me talking about these people who died so nobly. This is atrocious. this is horrific language. They died nobly. No, the fact is, we should be angry as hell that they died at all, and that they died in this way, and that they died for this reason. And this is not racism. I've been saying this. This is white supremacy. This is a pillar of the apartheid society in which we live that fully emboldens a young man, a white young man, whose only qualification here is that he has white skin, and that by virtue of that, he inherits all of this putrid race-based history of our country and acts on it in the same way his forebears, and I can't say him, his forebears personally, I don't know, but I'm talking about the group with which he identifies, political forebears, certainly, believed themselves entitled to act. I want to share with you President Obama's statements in the immediate aftermath of this awful tragedy. I want you to listen to how he dances around the issue. Here's President Obama.
I spoke with, and Vice President Biden spoke with, Mayor Joe Riley and other leaders at Charleston to express our deep sorrow over the senseless murders that took place last night. Michelle and I know several members of Emmanuel AME Church. We knew their pastor, Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who, along with eight others, gathered in prayer and fellowship and was murdered last night. And to say our thoughts and prayers are with them and their families and their community doesn't say enough to convey the heartache and the sadness and the anger that we feel. Any death of this sort is a tragedy. Any shooting involving multiple victims is a tragedy. There is something particularly heartbreaking about a death happening in a place in which we seek solace and we seek peace, in a place of worship. Mother Emmanuel is, in fact, more than a church. This is a place of worship that was founded by African Americans seeking liberty. This is a church that was burned to the ground because its worshipers worked to end slavery. When there were laws banning all black church gatherings, they conducted services in secret. When there was a nonviolent movement to bring our country closer in line with our highest ideals, some of our brightest leaders spoke and led marches from this church's steps. This is a sacred place in the history of Charleston and in the history of America. The FBI is now on the scene with local police, and more of the Bureau's best are on the way to join them. The Attorney General has announced plans for the FBI to open a hate crime investigation. We understand that the suspect is in custody, and I'll let the best of law enforcement do its work to make sure that justice is served. Until the investigation is complete, I'm necessarily constrained in terms of talking about the details of the case. But I don't need to be constrained about the emotions that tragedies like this raise. I've had to make statements like this too many times. Communities like this have had to endure tragedies like this too many times. We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Now is the time for mourning and for healing. But let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it. I say that recognizing the politics in this town foreclose a lot of those avenues right now. But it'd be wrong for us not to acknowledge it. And at some point, it's going to be important for the American people to come to grips with it. And for us to be able to shift how we think about the issue of gun violence collectively. The fact that this took place in a black church obviously also raises questions about a dark part of our history. This is not the first time that black churches have been attacked. And we know that hatred across races and faiths pose a particular threat to our democracy and our ideals. The good news is I am confident that the outpouring of unity and strength and fellowship and love across Charleston today, from all races, from all faiths, from all places of worship, indicates the degree to which those old vestiges of hatred can be overcome. That certainly was Dr. King's hope just over 50 years ago, after four little girls were killed in a bombing in a black church in Birmingham, Alabama. He said they lived meaningful lives, and they died nobly. They say to each of us, Dr. King said, black and white alike, that we must substitute courage for caution. They say to us that we must be concerned not merely with who murdered them, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murderers. Their death says to us that we must work passionately and unrelentingly for the realization of the American dream. And if one will hold on, he will discover that God walks with him and that God is able to lift you from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope and transform dark and desolate valleys into sunlit paths of inner peace. Reverend Pinckney and his congregation understood that spirit. Their Christian faith compelled them to reach out, not just to members of their congregation, or to members of their own communities, but to all in need. They opened their doors to strangers who might enter a church in search of healing or redemption. Mother Emanuel Church and its congregation have risen before, from flames, from an earthquake, from other dark times, to give hope to generations of Charlestonians. And with our prayers and our love and the buoyancy of hope, it will rise again now as a place of peace. Thank you.
What would you do differently on gun control?
President Obama speaking in the immediate aftermath of this great tragedy in South Carolina. But doing a very, very important task here, which is to transform the national reality and to revise a very clearly documented history of this country at the same time. Revisionism. This is not white supremacy. This is not a racist attack. This is not a deliberate act of an agent of white supremacy. This is now a matter of the need for gun control. This is about, as he put it, the hatred that it's hatred. See, it's just, it's a nice box to put it in. It's just hatred. A single individual and his hatred. This is not meant in any way to suggest that there's a broader view that is perfectly in line with this one individual's act and his thinking, which is very clear. I read the so-called manifesto, his rationale for his actions, and he's quite clear that he is a soldier in service of white supremacy. How did he get that message? He certainly had to be taught. This is not the dark history of America. This is the living reality of America that has been ignored for centuries. And here we have a president now playing, you know, diplomacy, playing the diplomatic role of taking the edge off. When we should be very clear, this is exactly what it is that people have been talking about and experiencing for hundreds of years in this country. But he reduces it to a hate crime. The FBI is investigating this as a hate crime. He removes, expunges a very important symbolism of this church, which I talked about earlier last week. This is a church founded by Denmark Vesey, a man of the cloth, but a man absolutely clear that the people were being oppressed on the basis of their race and were being killed and slaughtered on the basis of their race, and nobody was doing a thing about it. The government was also aiding and abetting the extermination of black people in this country. I referred again to the symbolism, if you will, of the very name of this church. The African Methodist Episcopal Church. Even within the church community, there was the standoff on the basis of race. The Methodist community decided that black people were not to be allowed to worship among whites. This is and these are God-fearing Americans. And so they devised their own system to accommodate their own spirituality. And they were very clear in the name of the church, an African Methodist Episcopal Church, a big fight going on in the Methodist community, in the good Christian community, based on race. We have this silly Hillary Clinton, herself a Methodist, missing that point. She's talking, and we'll get to that some point down the line when we start talking about real, really mentally ill people. We'll talk about her and her speech. But he has made this speech too many times, the president said. But he hasn't made the speech. He has not talked about race. He has not talked about racial oppression in this country, of which he is the titular head. Instead, this is not white supremacy. This is the fact that it illustrates that too many innocent people, he said, are killed because those wanting to do them harm can put their hands on guns. It is a matter of gun violence now. So he has restructured the whole debate. He has reclassified the reality that we know and that we have known for hundreds of years. And then, of course, the great 1-2 punch. It always is convenient to quote Dr. King at times like this. Well, Dr. King was functioning in his capacity as a preacher, trying to give people a sense of hope in the middle of utter despair. That the KKK could come to a church and care nothing about the lives of the individuals there, but caring more to convey the same message that the gunman, Mr. Roof, intended to communicate. You are not safe at all from us. We can reach you at any time. We can annihilate you at any time. And our intention is to utterly and completely control you, and if we can't, to annihilate you, to destroy you. This is terrorism. But those words, a word like that, will never escape Barack Obama's lips, because, as he said, we are a civilized country. We don't have terrorism here. What we have are people who are a little demented and can get guns. What we have here are people who are just hateful. One of the encouraging pieces of reporting that I have seen in the aftermath of this massacre was an editorial in the Tampa Bay Times of Florida. It is the largest newspaper in Florida. Just yesterday, it ran an editorial that I think is worthy of your attention. It is titled, "Terrorist or Mentally Ill? All a Matter of Color." I will read it to you. Police are investigating last week's shooting of 9 African Americans at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston as a hate crime committed by a white man. Unfortunately, it's not a unique event in American history. Black churches have long been a target of white supremacists who burned and bombed them in an effort to terrorize the black communities that those churches anchored. One of the most egregious terrorist acts in U.S. history was committed against a black church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963. 4 girls were killed when members of the KKK bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church, a tragedy that ignited the civil rights movement. But listen to major media outlets, and you won't hear the word terrorism used in coverage of the shooting. You won't hear the white male shooter, 21-year-old Dylan Roof, described as, quote, a possible terrorist, unquote. The go-to explanation for his actions will be mental illness. He will be humanized and called sick, a victim of inadequate mental health resources. Activist DeRay McKesson noted that while discussing Roof's motivations, an MSNBC anchor said, quote, "We don't know his mental condition," unquote. That is the power of whiteness in America. U.S. media practice a different policy when covering crimes involving African Americans and Muslims. As suspects, they are quickly categorized as terrorists and thugs motivated by evil intent instead of external injustices. While white suspects are lone wolves, Mayor Joseph Riley of Charleston already emphasized the shooting was an act of just one hateful person, unquote. Violence by black and Muslim people is systemic, demanding response and action from all who share their race or religion. Even black victims are vilified. Trayvon Martin was wearing a hoodie. Michael Brown stole cigars. Eric Garner sold Lucy cigarettes. When a black teenager who committed no crime was tackled and held down by a police officer at a pool party in McKinney, Texas, Fox News host Megyn Kelly described her as, quote, no saint either, unquote. Early reports on the Charleston church shooting followed a similar pattern. Cable news coverage of state senator and the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, pastor of Emmanuel AME, who was among the victims, categorized his advocacy work as something that could ruffle feathers. The habit of categorizing black victims as somehow complicit in their own murders continues. It will be difficult to hold to this corrosive, racist media narrative when reporting on the shooting at Emmanuel AME Church. Those who were killed were participating in a Wednesday night Bible study, and the shooter's choice of Emmanuel AME was most likely deliberate, given its storied history. It was the first African Methodist Episcopal Church in the South, founded in 1818 by a group of men including Morris Brown, a prominent pastor, and Denmark Vesey, the leader of a large yet failed slave revolt in Charleston. The church itself was targeted early on by fearful whites because it was built with funds from anti-slavery societies in the North. In 1822, church members were investigated for involvement in planning Vesey's slave revolt, and the church was burned to the ground in retribution. With that context, it's clear that these killings constituted a deliberate act of hate. There was a message of intimidation behind the shooting, an act that mirrors a history of terrorism against black institutions involved in promoting civil and human rights. The hesitation on the part of some of the media to label the white male killer a terrorist is telling. In the rapidly forming news narrative, the fact that black churches and mosques historically have been the targets of racial violence in America should not be overlooked. Recognition of the terror these acts impose on communities seems to have been forgotten post-September 11. The subsequent Islamophobia that has gripped sectors of media and politics suggests that terrorism only applies in cases where the suspects are darker skinned. Reporters and newscasters must ask the questions that get to the root of acts of racially motivated violence in America. Where did this man learn to hate black people? Was he influenced by right-wing media's endless portrayals of black Americans as lazy and violent? Media coverage should not fall back on the typical narrative ascribed to white male shooters. A lone, disturbed, or mentally ill young man failed by society. This is not an act of just, quote, one hateful person, unquote. It is a manifestation of the racial hatred and white supremacy that continues to pervade our society. The authorities have found their suspect and we should be calling him what he is, a terrorist. This was actually written by a professor, Butler, associate professor of religion and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and printed in the Tampa Bay Times. And it underscores exactly what I've been saying. But here we have none other than the President of the United States engaging in revisionism, being tactful, being diplomatic about something that is so heinous and yet so familiarly American: white supremacy. That's the bottom line. We will have a lot of this going on because, as I said, this white supremacy is a system of control. And all nations have one form of it or the other, essentially, a system of control. It doesn't matter what the racial makeup is. There is a system. It happens that in the United States, this pernicious philosophy, if you want to call it that, is at the root of a lot of dysfunction, but also at the root of the power mechanisms in this country. It affects all of our lives. Whether you're white or black or polka dot, it doesn't matter. It allows people to identify themselves with the group that is powerful on the basis of their skin. It allows those on the flip side of that coin to internalize their subjugation. And in both cases, to operate in a kind of distorted, psychotic world. One group believes itself divinely ordained to rule by every means necessary, the other to accept their subjugation, and to turn these feelings, these reminders, these daily reminders of your inferior position in a society, literally to turn it on yourself. It is a sick society. When the president talks about the fact that no other country has this, well, he's also very clearly disconnected from history. What do you think is the reason that people set sail from Britain in the first place? They were subjugated. What was the War of Independence about? Refusal to be subjugated. This is white-on-white subjugation on the basis of class. But even before they set foot in the United States, they set foot in America, even before they got here, they knew and they intended that whoever they met here would be absolutely inferior to them. They were perhaps emboldened by the philosophy, if one would call it that. The prevailing philosophy in Britain at the time was that while they differ with each other, they're all in agreement that people of color just were lower, perhaps, even than animals. The raging political talk at the time was between a great Calvinist, Thomas Carlyle, and John Stuart Mill, a nobleman, sort of. And they were raging, having this major political debate. And the holy man, the Christian man, Carlyle, talked about the nigger question. How do you solve the nigger question? And certainly it is because you have to formulate the system of total control, because that's what's appropriate when you're dealing with animals. It is the most racist thing you would ever read in your life. Good Christian man. John Stuart Mill responded on the basis of economics, but rebutted Carlyle's view that people of African descent the world over should not be regarded as, should be regarded as human, of course, and should enjoy the same rights and privileges as everyone else. But this was not the prevailing view in Britain. And Britain, therefore, went right ahead. How else do you explain that a small speck of dust compared to the continents it subjugated? Britain subjugated India. It subjugated huge portions of Africa. The sun never did set on the British Empire. How did that happen? The system of subjugation was refined. The philosophies propagated, militarily enforced. Social societies, false social societies were created in countries that had civilizations long before the first Briton ever existed. But I explained that this race oppression is so deeply ingrained, but it is a science. It is an applied science, and it is key to global power, global subjugation. And when they have constructed a false society, an artificial society, with everyone learning his or her role and which part of the wheel they occupied, the big British Empire wheel that they occupied, and were sufficiently trusted to understand how to do their jobs and the presence of the military to make sure that you complied. That is how you rule. So when the president naively says that no other society does this, he is clearly completely disconnected from history, including U.S. history. Because that was the mindset that was imported here and refined here, and refined so well that it looked attractive to people like Adolf Hitler, who said, well, wait a minute, this must have some kind of merit. And what do you know? The blacks of Germany were the Jews. And they were exterminated. And the Roma people, who were called gypsies, were exterminated. And a whole realm of science as it developed in the United States to prove the scientific inferiority of people of color in order to justify their subjugation. It was all propagated here and exported and reinforced militarily and reinforced through their social and legal systems. So this is not a game. This is not one individual just waking up one day and deciding, hey, I could do this, and I'm going to go on a rampage. He is naive, but he is conscious. His political consciousness was very carefully developed, and he was inculcated in this way of thinking. And that's what makes this different from a hate crime. But the United States is not ready. The president is not ready to discuss white supremacy. I told you the designer of the flag was really clear about that. This is what the flag means. It's about white supremacy and divinely ordained white supremacy. Going back to the British way of thinking. We are divinely ordained to subjugate everybody, to kill them off if we have to, with impunity. So you make the person who is your target, you make them into nothing. And you see to it through terror, to sheer terror, you see to it that they get that message, that they can do nothing about their circumstances. This is the condition we are living with for hundreds of years. And yet, people would prefer, including the president, would prefer to kind of suggest that that's way in our past. We should be thinking differently now. We are, after all, a very evolved society. We're not that primitive anymore. So much progress has been made. And look, we've had a civil rights movement and everything. So we're not that. We are no longer in what he euphemistically called the dark days of this nation. We're very much in the dark days of this nation. So dark that even he can't express his opinion. He can't come out and say exactly what it is. He can't call it. And he knows it. I bring this to your attention to, again, continue the conversation that we've been having about this pernicious thing called white supremacy. The reality of our condition as a people and as a nation is that we are bound up by it. Some of us are demented, so we see nothing. We convince ourselves of our progress. We convince ourselves that what we know to be the truth, it just simply doesn't exist. And so we invent new realities that we are comfortable living with, and we adopt these psychotic ways of operating, these schizophrenic ways of operating, this demented way of operating every day, partly because it is key to our survival, because I think if we were to really internalize this reality, it would stop us from functioning. It is so heavy. But in the scheme of things, in this power equation, one side of the equation can afford this. They can afford to indulge themselves in these flights of fancy, and they can indulge in the revisionism that we are hearing about and seeing every day, because they understand the real power equation and who has the power in this country, so they could pretend. Because at the end of the day, to quote the familiar phrase these days, they know they are part of the power equation, and in some cases, they are the power elite. What I'm asking people to do is, if you identify on the other side of the equation as being a member of a class of oppressed people, and there's enough evidence to suggest that millions of people in this country, particularly people of color, but not exclusively, because white people, poor white people too, are not part of the power elite. But if you consider yourself part of a class on the other side of the equation, it's time to get real about devising systems of survival, long-term survival. And this is what Denmark Vesey had tried to do in the 1800s, paid for it with his life. And that little thing that the president just said, well, this is where they burned and burned down the church, and this is where, you know. What he is doing is communicating to us that he is aware of the history, but refuses to acknowledge it as is. He was referring to Denmark Vesey, but would not call his name. Too controversial, too black, too strong. And people who didn't identify with Vesey and so forth and thought that he was, upsetting the apple cart and the church was burned down. That was because of Denmark Vesey saying to his beleaguered community, we've got to fight. At some point, we have to fight. And he was enslaved. And he was correct. He took the position. We have to resist enslavement, mass enslavement, mass murders of our people, the forfeiture of our future. We have to resist it. The president will not say that. He instead comes at it in a soft way and refuses to acknowledge that this is American history. This is not conjecture, this is fact. So where does that leave us? We come back to the central theme of constructing systems, especially those, the people who have power, they have no particular obligation to construct anything because it's been constructed. And they're beneficiaries, direct beneficiaries of that. The people who are on the receiving end of things need to wake up, get real. That brings me to the end of the program today. I thank you so much for joining me and allowing me to speak frankly to you, as I expect that you would once we are able to communicate with each other. The phone lines should be up and running very, very soon, and we can resume our customary connection with each other. Keep it right here for more great programming on PRN.FM. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you, and I thank you sincerely for the pleasure and the great privilege of your esteemed company. Bye-bye. See you tomorrow.
In the world through my own eyes, I am sitting here wanting memories.